Becky Brown with your November Collective. We are so grateful for your support of the ministry that is making a difference in the lives of so many people. I just heard a quote the other day that said, generosity is the way that God changes lives. Isn't that amazing when you think about, not even just from a financial standpoint, but sometimes our generosity can be seen in our attitude towards each other, giving grace to each other. In this season of Thanksgiving, I think a generous spirit speaks volumes about what God has done in your life. I want to say thank you for how you are helping us make a difference in the lives of so many people. And with Thanksgiving here, and it's the beginning of the holidays, it all seems to come so fast, but we're thankful for you. And we want to say that not just because it's Thanksgiving or that time of the year, but also because you can never know this side of heaven what a difference your giving has made. Everybody that we have been able to help will have different holidays this year, and you're a part of that. Each of you are part of the extension of New Life in so many areas and places in this world, and we hope that God will be in the center of your holidays. We're looking forward to what happens in the holidays. Some of us have expectations that may not be met. The difference between expectations and reality is misery. And so I'm just praying that you're going to have a great time together, however it happens. But of course, if you have some struggles in your family connections, we can help you with that too. We have two short teachings with subjects that might pop up during this holiday season. J.J. West is going to speak on the topic of disappointment, and Dr. Jim Burns will talk about conflict. After that, we're going to have Mark Cameron and Dr. Alice Benton weigh in on a situation where Julie is wondering about what next steps to take. Her adult daughter is irresponsible in her own life's decisions, then affects the lives of her three children. Let's listen in to some wisdom from J.J., Jim, Mark, and Alice.
What I want to start us off with today is this whole idea of how we interpret, especially disappointments in life. Because so oftentimes I think what happens is we'll be on a plan and life is going the way we want it to go. And we think, okay, I'm in God's will. I'm doing what he wants me to do. And then we get hit with this curveball. Some monkey wrench gets thrown in. And then we start wrestling with, okay, so where is this from? Is this God
right,
trying to direct me elsewhere? Mm-hmm. Or is this the enemy trying to thwart God's plan? And we wrestle, where is this coming from? Who's at fault here, right? And I think a better question to ask is not who's at fault, because the truth is, I think scripture backs this up. Everything that happens in our lives, whether it's what we wanted to happen or completely opposite of what we wanted to happen and everything in between, everything in our lives, God wants to use for good, to draw us closer to him and to shape us more into his image. Mm-hmm. And everything that happens, the good, the things we wanted and the things we absolutely didn't want and everything in between, the enemy wants to use to draw us away from God, to get our focus off of him. And so it's really not a question of who's at fault, who sent this. Was it from God or from the enemy? The real question is, how can I allow this thing, whatever it is, whether it's a blessing or a disappointment, how can I let this thing draw me closer to God and shape my character and my image and my goals more in line with who God is and what he has for me, rather than letting this thing take me off track, which is what the enemy wants. And so it changes the way we experience life, and especially the disappointments of life. Instead of wrestling with, why did this happen, God? Now I'm questioning, God, what do you want to do with this disappointment in my life? How do you want to use it to grow me and to help me to be more dependent on you and more aware of your presence in my life?
I'm going to talk about a word that actually can be a good word, but it's conflict.
You know, when people are in conflict, we always think that's horrible. And I've been a conflict avoider all of my life. I'm learning some things. Communication's a learned trait, Jackie, as you know.
You're a lover, not a fighter.
Boy, am I. I'm a runner sometimes, not a fighter. You could just ask my wife of 51 years now, okay? But, you know, with conflict, you know, we have negative conflict, what I call the negative conflict dance or the positive conflict dance. So let's talk about this. Maybe some of our listeners can identify with me, because this is kind of me too. You know, we have tension and friction and problems and pain and whatnot. And when we do the negative conflict dance, we go right to the defensiveness. Mm-hmm. It's normal. We do that, but it stops good communication. And when we have defensiveness, you know, we start blaming or we get anger. And one of the questions I always have to ask is, do I want to be right or do I want to have a better relationship? Sometimes I need to keep this mouth of mine quiet. But defensiveness is not going to work, but we tend to go there. We get defensive, then we move to what I call disconnect, because if you're defensive for too long, you disconnect in your relationship. And that's when, you know, you emotionally withdraw. Kathy said a phrase, she hasn't said it for years, but she used to always say, I feel like you're crawling in your cave, emotional withdrawal. And then you move to kind of being detached. So now we've got a lot of people in relationships because of tension and conflict where they're bitter, they're resentful, they have contempt. Some of them are lonely, unresolved issues, fighting, deadness. I mean, we're going to hopefully have some callers who talk about that today because that's the deal. That moves to deeper tension and regret. But I want to teach the positive conflict dance today very quickly. Well, we start with tension, right? But then instead of moving to defensiveness, we move to we. How do we resolve this issue? How do we assume responsibility for whatever the issues are together? And when we do that, now I'm not blaming Kathy. She's not blaming me, but we're trying to resolve the issue by becoming a we. What can we do to resolve this issue? And you know what happens when I do that, and I'm trying my best, is we get connected. And when we're connected, we don't have to agree on everything. Mm-hmm. Now we're not doing the win or lose on each other. Or that blame game, we're learning new things about each other. We're learning new things. And I feel connected even when there has been tension. And again, we don't have to always agree. And then, of course, what you move to is what I call authentic oneness and feeling loved. And you can do that within conflict. So that's my thought for this morning.
All right. Jackie, any thoughts on Jim's thoughts?
I love the idea of feeling loved while in conflict, right? It's so opposite of what we usually think about.
Here is Julie in Kentucky, listening on Sirius XM channel 131. Welcome, Julie, to New Life Live.
Hi, thank you for taking my call today. My question to you all today is, basically, I have a 32-year-old daughter who has three children by three different fathers, and my question to you is, am I helping, hindering, or overstepping? The situation is she's a single mom. Has needed help throughout. She got pregnant very early on at 18 years of age and has needed help, whether it be physically, financially, basically since then. I have been a primary caregiver with her for all three of her children. Situations have not been great. She's kind of ebbed and flowed as far as getting back on her feet, feeling better and more secure. Then she gets in a relationship with some guy and things kind of tank and the kids get left behind. The recent scenario that has happened that's brought me into this phone call today is I had the oldest granddaughter for a soccer tournament this weekend and went to bring her home. The mother was at, her mom was MIA, my daughter, all weekend, couldn't get a hold of her. She was supposed to show up, never did. She showed up finally, told me that she was going to be coming home, which the home that she has is a home that I purchased for her so her children could have a stable home and would not bounce around from one environment to another, which she was doing with the understanding that she would contribute. She would, you know, do those things, pay rent. You know, my goal is always to try to help her on her feet. Well, I went over there. She had left. You know, I found out she's been leaving these animals. She's got two dogs, has cats in the home, no food, no water. The house was just wrecked completely. I was mortified. The animals were starving.
Okay, that's okay. We understand.
It was just devastating to find the home and the animals in that state. And you're worried what is happening to your grandchildren when you're not there.
Well, they tell me they're old enough. The 7-year-old tells me, the 13-year-old tells me, and I try to get them on weekends, and I go over and I try to help clean and do laundry, buy groceries, and it's just not good enough. It's just not enough. They wanted me to stay. I had gotten, went to store groceries. The exterior was in horrible shape. I cleaned as best as I could. I started laundry. My daughter was upset with me for intervening, that I had no business to be there. And I had no business, you know, to say this is not okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, yet she wants you to rescue her in the times when she's between relationships. Hey, Julie, well, yeah, I mean, I'm feeling for you here where you feel stuck, because I think what you're saying here is, am I overstepping by helping my daughter? But if I stop doing that, then the grandkids suffer. So I need to help them. But then that continues enabling her. And so then round and around and around you go. I think that's what you're saying. Right. Right? Yeah. Yeah. And so you're stuck in the cycle. And so she's, you know, to quote a song here, she's looking for love in all the wrong places. Mm-hmm. And between those, you know, so she's not seeking healthy relationships, and then she's invested and she's all in, and it sounds like there's some type of neglect that's happening with the kids. And then that ultimately breaks down, and then you step in and you become like the stable parent, you know, that she should have with a spouse. Right. Now, I think you need to tease the two things apart here, because absolutely should you step in and help your grandkids if they are not getting their physical needs met. But at the same time, there's this enabling of your daughter. And so it sounds like she can't really take care of herself. So she doesn't really know how to take care of them. And there may need to be some consequences that happen out of that you might have to legally go and get temporary custody of her children so that she can learn, so that she can get into recovery for herself. You have to have stabilization first before she can get into recovery here. And that may be a really, really difficult thing to do. But if there's no food in the house for the animals, and that could possibly be the case for the children too. So this is a serious thing. I mean, it's really difficult to do that, because that creates a lot of tension to say or do something like that. What are you thinking when I suggest that to you?
It's everything that I think of it in my own mind. And then I think that because of this cycle, and I know she's stuck, and it's like we take two steps ahead, and I'm all about having her stand on her own 2 feet. I don't want to be the parent, but I love my grandkids. I mean, I've invested. I'm here. I'm all in. They look for me. They need me. They don't have a stable father. They have nobody else. Mm-hmm. And I will not turn my back on them, but I don't want to continue to this, like you said, this really bad cycle we are in between my daughter and I, and they are two separate issues. How do I, she knows she has me, you know what I mean?
Well,
that's
what I'm saying. You got to separate those two things apart. You absolutely should be there for your kids. So that's what I'm saying. You may have to get temporary custody of your grandchildren. Now you separate those two things apart. Now she has to deal with the consequences of getting her life together. You can still love her. You can still be there for her, but then you don't have to continue enabling her, but then your grandchildren are taken care of. So that's what you need to do, is pull those two things apart, because when they stay together, of course, you're going to need to take care of those kids, but then it just enables that cycle.
So that may start by, Julie, you letting your daughter know, this is not working, and I'm afraid of the state of what's going on in your home, and I'm going to have to take action to protect the children. Mm-hmm. Now, daughter, you said that last night?
I did that yesterday. Yes.
All right. There's a second part to it. Daughter, if you're willing to get help right now, if you're willing to get connected with a clinician, I wouldn't be surprised if your daughter might need inpatient care. I'm wondering about substance use. If you're willing to get help now, then we might be able to work this out while I still take custody while you're in rehab. but I'm not able to let this go on in this way anymore. And if she refuses to get help and get treatment, you'll probably have to rethink her being allowed to live in this home that you purchased for her so generously. And you purchased it for the grandchildren, but it does allow her to continue to make really unhealthy choices because she's got a place to land every time. And then I'd also have you, Julie, look into what level of support do you need to make such awful stances with your own daughter? Because maybe you feel guilty for why she started making these choices. Maybe you feel the compassion for what her life was like growing up as a kid. Because, of course, there were imperfections in what went on in the home. And so that might keep you rescuing her because you feel somewhat responsible for why she's struggling. Does any of that hold true for you?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So 100%. Let us connect you with a counselor to help you, because boundaries are easy to talk about. They are. They feel almost impossible to put into place and hold when your daughter's crying or raging at you, when your grandchildren are scared and lonely and calling you. Then, of course, rescue seems like the best option, but it's a short-term option that keeps everybody stuck.
Right. Yes. Very much, yes.
All right, Julie, stay on the phone. We'll send you a copy of Boundaries, and we'll put you in touch with somebody from our network. What advice would you give to parents who maybe are thinking, well, yeah, my grown kids are doing this because I did something to them, or I didn't, you know, I wasn't there for them when they were kids, so now it's my chance to make up for that and always come to their rescue. How do you put a stop to that?
We make up for the pain we caused by confessing it, acknowledging it, asking, tell me how it affected you, and let's talk together, brainstorm about how I can make amends to you. And making amends is so different than enabling, because enabling leads to a person staying immature and stuck, and that's not helping anybody. Mm-hmm. That's keeping them stuck. So it's differentiating. How do I make amends and rebuild trust versus rescuing an adult child?
Yeah. Mark, any thoughts?
Yeah, no, I agree with what Alice is saying here. Yes, while we have contributed to the way our adult children turn out, they ultimately maintain responsibility for their healing. But as we confess, it gives them a place to go to and make sense of it.
Our next teaching is from our Life Recovery Conference. We have an online conference, and we draw people from all over the world who participate in our Life Recovery groups. Did you know that we have over 700 groups that meet each week across the world? Isn't it amazing that so many people want to find freedom in their lives and we get to be part of it? We are grateful for that. In one of the topics, we talked about grief and loss. We all experience grief and loss throughout the year. Grief comes in many forms, and Stephanie Frazier, who's one of our network therapists and coaches, will inform us on the variety of grief that comes through other losses, the benefits, and the process. Let's listen in as Stephanie shares on grief and loss.
I want to start out my time by asking a question. Do you want to be healed? Do you want to be healed? You know, this was the same question that Jesus asked a man after 38 years of being invalid and paralyzed. Can you imagine? Jesus walked up to this man and said, do you want to be healed? I can only imagine what the man was thinking. Yes. But after 23 years of walking alongside hurting people, I've learned that people who walked away healed were the people who were willing to grieve their losses. That's where healing lies. So during our time today, I want to define what is grieving. We'll also cover what grieving is not by exploring five common myths and five common fears. We'll talk about the benefits and purposes of grieving. And lastly, I want to leave you with a healthy grieving checklist. By covering seven things that are part of a healthy grieving process. So as we begin our time, if you gain the courage to heal, you gain the courage to begin to face your grief and grieving your losses, then the goal for my time has been accomplished and you win. So let's jump in. What is grieving? Grieving is the natural way we respond to loss. experiencing its pain, honoring its meaning, and gradually finding a new way to live with it. Now, that's a lot. That's a big definition. Really, grieving our losses just means facing our loss, facing them with lots of grief, with lots of grace and lots of compassion. And as we allow whatever happens as we face it to happen. You know, most people associate grieving with death. However, we now know that we can experience the loss of anything to which we are attached and is important to us. So the loss on your sheet there, the list of losses, it says losses that we may need to grieve include death, relationships, the loss of our health, childhood, loss of dreams, security. Life changes definitely register as a loss, even if they're good changes. And addiction. There's a lot of losses in addiction. So as you look at this list, what losses have you experienced? I'm going to give us a few seconds here. What I want you to do is I want you to write down all the losses that come to mind as you look at this list. Just have some courage right now and write down the losses that come up for you as you look at that list. And as we continue to move through my section and losses come up, just keep adding to your list. Because again, a big part of grieving is just facing them. So what are the purposes or benefits of grieving? Well, amazing verse, Matthew 5:4 says, God blesses those who mourn, for they will be comforted. That's a promise that when we face the grief of our losses, that God will comfort us. And he'll also use others to bring comfort to us as well. Some other benefits of grieving. It helps us accept our loss rather than deny or avoid it. It prevents long-term emotional and physical harm. We know that when we hold pain in our bodies, it harms us because we're holding in the stress hormone cortisol. Listen to how awesome God is in the way that he made our bodies to heal. Research shows there's three types of tears. One type is called emotional tears. Emotional tears are the tears that we have when we grieve or when we process pain. They've researched and they've tested these tears, and they found higher levels of protein and hormone in them, including and specifically high levels of cortisol, the stress hormone. So when you feel the grief of your loss and you let the tears come out, you're actually letting toxicity come out of your body, because that cortisol, that stress hormone, is actually coming out from your tears. So pretty amazing. We grieve our losses and God allows our body to be detoxed. We physically get healthier when we grieve those losses. Pretty amazing. It also allows us to celebrate and respect what was important within the loss. So it allows us to celebrate and respect what was important within the loss. Another benefit is it gradually restores hope. Who doesn't want hope? It restores hope, and it also brings more resilience to our lives. And lastly, it deepens empathy. It deepens our ability to walk with others in our loss. A beautiful verse in the Bible on this piece of deepening our empathy is in 2 Corinthians 1:3-4, it says, "Praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who comforts us in all our griefs and in turn allows us to comfort those with the same comfort we have received." How cool. So when we grieve our losses, we then gain capacity to be able to sit with others and provide that safe space so they can grieve and heal as well. It deepens our relationship with God. And it also, grieving deepens our self-understanding. We get to learn more about who God made us. And that God absolutely wants us to know more about who we are and how he wants us to live out in this world. So grief truly transforms us. So with all these benefits and purposes for our grieving, What stops us from grieving? How come we don't grieve? Well, Psalm 35 there on your book says, weeping may last through the night, but joy comes from the morning. You know, that weeping lasting through the night, I think, scares us. That's part of the problem. But when we face it, we get that joy in the morning. In this next section, as we go through these, I want you to take time to mark which ones you can identify with, or ones that you've experienced yourself, because this could actually be the key to getting you unstuck. I'm going to start with the five common fears, and I'm going to say each fear, and then I'm going to say the truth of that instead. And so you can write down, if you want, the truth next to the fear. All right. Again, listen and hear which ones have you maybe felt fear over, and let's let the truth set you free. If I let myself feel it, I'll never stop crying. Whew, that's a big fear. Most of my childhood, I held that one. When my dad passed when I was 4 years old due to a horrific car accident when I was 2 months old, I spent most of my childhood just working really hard to not deal with that loss. It was too painful. And so I just kept busy. But I believed this lie. I thought, if I start crying, I will never stop. And man, did it keep me stuck until I finally got help for that. So the truth is, emotions come in waves, but allowing feelings helps healing. Next, common fear. My grief will overwhelm others. I think a lot of people feel this one too. The truth is, sharing grief can actually deepen connection. It doesn't push people away. So the opposite is true. So the truth is, sharing grief can deepen connection, not push people away. If I move forward, I will forget my loved one. The truth is, healing means carrying love in new ways, not letting go. You know, the reality is, guys, is we never forget or stop loving those we lost. It doesn't happen. So we don't have to fear that one. I am not grieving the right way. The truth is, everyone's grief looks different. There's no single path. And the last fear is time alone. Time alone will heal me. The truth is, time helps, but healing often, most of the time, requires support and making meaning of our loss and our life now with the loss in it. Have you experienced any of these fears in regards to your losses? Well, may the truths of these really set you free. Now, as we go into the five common myths of grieving, again, just kind of listen, and which ones maybe have you believed? Which ones have you held? Grief follows neat stages. The reality is, grief is not linear. It loops, it shifts, it surprises. The second common myth is crying is the only way to grieve. Nope. The reality is, people grieve through many expressions. Talking about their loss is powerful. Creating art, music, journaling, moving, praying, and even silence. These are all appropriate expressions of grief. There's a set timeline. Have you ever felt pressure to hurry up and be done? Well, the reality is, grief doesn't expire. Its intensity changes, but the love remains. Being strong, this one's a big one as a counselor. Being strong means hiding emotions. Nope. The reality is, true strength is being real with what you feel. And then the last myth here is, still grieving must mean that I'm stuck. Still grieving equals stuck. The reality is, ongoing waves of grief reflect ongoing love, not failure. And in fact, when we are grieving, we are no longer stuck. So again, hearing these five myths for yourself, are there any that you believe or believed? And just mark that and reflect on that and really take in the realities and the truths of these. Okay. Lastly, how do we grieve? So people are like, okay, I'm willing. Now what do I do? Well, I am going to walk you through and talk about a healthy grieving checklist. little cheat sheet. And I've listed seven things there that you can look at and to determine and help you to grieve healthy. Actually, I'll start with that verse there. Psalm 34:18 says, "The Lord is close to the brokenhearted. He rescues those whose spirits are crushed." I don't know about you, but man, the times that my heart has been broken, the Lord has been the closest. I have felt him many times rescue me from a very crushed spirit. So that verse is very true, and I'm super grateful for that. All right, let's jump in. First one, acknowledge the loss. This one, we want to name what has been lost and its impact on us. Okay, so that's how we acknowledge it. We name it, and then we acknowledge what its impact has been on our lives. And even just you guys creating that list of your losses today has already allowed you to begin number one here. So good job with that. Number two, feel and express emotions. We want to allow any feelings that surface, such as sadness, anger. Sometimes we feel guilt, relief, and sometimes confusion. All of our feelings and emotions are welcome and necessary to let surface, because then we can process them and let them go. All right, seek support. You've been hearing a lot about this today. Yes, it's a necessary ingredient for healing. Seeking support. I heard this quote more recently that said, "Most people would rather grieve alone for 10 days than grieve in front of another person for 10 minutes. Oof. We don't want to seek support, and yet it's so necessary. This is really sad fact, because two, we need people the most when we're at our lowest. These are times when we want to lean on trusted friends, family, support groups, faith communities, life recovery groups through New Life are fantastic to grieve your losses. I have been able to face really heavy losses in my life recovery groups, and I am so grateful for them. And also counselors, when you just don't even know which step to take and which direction to go, get a referral from New Life for a counselor. That's a beautiful place to start grieving these losses and have the safety to do so. And then also among seeking support, we need to share our story and accept comfort without judgment. One of the things Chris Williams always says is we need a benevolent or compassionate witness to our pain. This brings great healing. So guys, there's no way around it. We need people. And I like to say we deserve people to be in our lives in this way, to support and love on us. Okay, number four, honor the loss and honor ourselves. We want to honor the loss, but we also want to honor ourselves going through the loss with grace and compassion. We want to celebrate what was meaningful or special about the relationship or the experience. And so we want to honor that. We also, number five, we want to care for our body and ways that we can do that. Of course, we want to maintain sleep, rest, have good nutrition, gentle movement. We also want to use grounding techniques, prayer to calm our minds and our bodies, breathing, short walks, quiet times with God. Boy, we need that hope just being poured in from the Lord during our grieving. These are all great ways to care for our bodies. Number six, make meaning. What does make meaning mean? Well, reflect on lessons learned. Make meaning by really reflecting on spiritual insights, also God's presence through the loss. We also want to make meaning by finding hope and understanding and faith while integrating the grief. And we want to lean into God for hope as we grieve. We want to let God make sense of that loss for us. He's the only one that really can make sense of some of these losses that we go through. And number seven, last one, reinvest in life gradually. What does that mean? Well, it's time to allow space for joy again, relationships, and purpose while carrying the grief. to reinvest in life gradually means trusting God as you learn to live with both sorrow and love together. Now, as we finish our time together, I want you to take a minute to write down three takeaways or three nuggets that were most meaningful to you. Like, how did you just hear from God during this grieve your losses session? Three things, write those down. Take a minute to write those down. How is God speaking to you? As you write those down and consider those three takeaways, one last thing I want you to highly consider, and that is, I want you to consider one goal, one intentional thing that you will do to grieve your losses. What does that mean? Well, think of just one thing that you will begin to do and take a step, one step. So one intentional thing, it could look like joining a life recovery group as I did. That was one of the best steps I've taken to grieve my losses. It could be, like I said, calling a counselor. It could be picking up the phone and calling a friend and being super honest and saying, I know I haven't shared this with you, but I think I need to. I'm really hurting over this loss. But decide today one intentional thing that you will do and write that down. You know, it says goals written have an 80% chance higher of getting accomplished than goals just thought. So write your goal down, one intentional thing you will do to push yourself to heal.
Many of us feel awkward and don't feel like taking responsibility when we mess up. And when we don't own up, it affects how others trust us in the future. Our next section features two teachings, Dr. Sherry Denham Keffer on the topic of ownership, and then Dr. Jackie Mack Harris on rebuilding trust. Following the teachings, Chris Williams and Dr. Jill Hubbard will answer Amber's question on forgiveness.
I'm wrestling with something, and I'm wrestling with it, and I just want to throw it out there for a conversation, an open conversation here, because I think it's really hard to own things. I think it's hard to take ownership over the things we've done that hurt somebody. I think it's easier to be hurt than it is to actually annihilate somebody's heart and then take ownership for the harm that you did. And so in the world of addiction, which, you know, I spend a lot of time in the world of sex addiction, I often have the one who has betrayed say things like, well, I was drinking alcohol or using cocaine, or I have this addict self that was acting out. And as far as I can see, that's blame. It's blaming. It's saying, this is the thing. And you might as well say the devil made me do that. And I don't think that that's ownership, because we do have volition. We make choices. But I watch betrayed partners suffer, waiting for the one that betrayed them to own it 100%. And I feel like these are good women. These are women in my research. 88% of them said, I would stay. I would stay if the one I'm with would stop lying, right? Mm-hmm. But in my practice, it's like a 96th percentile. Most people work through it, even with the most horrible things that could ever happen. Mm-hmm. But that piece of ownership, which in the Bible, it's, oh, wretched man that I am, or mm-hmm. it's, oh, wretched woman that I am, depending upon who's caused harm. It's such a level of depth that you have to face being ashamed and face the harm and say, yes, I did it.
Yeah. And I experience that with the couples that I work with as well. People have a really hard time saying, yeah, I did that. I messed up. It was my fault. I'm the cause. People have a terrible time with that. And unfortunately, the healing doesn't really start to take place until you do.
No, it doesn't. Both people stay like in a tubal pregnancy. They're mm-hmm. stuck.
They're stuck. They're stuck.
And so if you're the person who may have been the offender, know that it will only get better when you lean into the admission of guilt, to take the risk, because otherwise you're just going to be holding your breath and you're going to experience life less than what God had intended. And there is nothing like the freedom that comes from confession in a safe and healthy, encouraging relationship. It may not turn out the way that you like it, but it is worth taking the risk.
What's on my mind today is trust. Okay. I've been reading Henry Cloud's book, Trust, again, and this scripture came to mind, Psalm 51. And it's this conversation, this prayer David is having as he's wanting to rebuild trust with God, because he knows how he's been. He knows how he's behaved, and he understands that God's judgment against him and his sin is just. But he confesses his part and he asks to be restored. He admits his fault. And he asked to be restored and to be forgiven and to be healed. And that's a part of rebuilding trust. So often people harm their loved ones and then they say they're sorry and they expect that that has rebuilt trust, and it has not. And then it happens again, or something else happens again, and they say you're unforgiving. And it's not that the person is unforgiving, but they're hurt. And you have to acknowledge that you caused that pain and do some work to repent. And here in Psalm 51, verse 16, you do not desire sacrifice or you would offer one. You know, sometimes people will say, oh, well, fine, I'll just never talk again. Right. That's that sacrifice. Right. You're going to just throw this thing out kind of passive aggressively. Mm-hmm. But if that's what I wanted, I would have said, don't talk to me anymore. We're done. Right. Mm-hmm. So that's not helpful. You're not actually rebuilding trust. You're just throwing more logs on the fire. And what we really want to do is to change your behavior in such a way that you don't have to make a sacrifice. That changed behavior shows your heart of repentance and your desire to restore the relationship. So when you say, you know what, I'm so sorry. I promised you that I wouldn't say that phrase to you again. I wouldn't say that name again. And I did it again. I'm really sorry. Can we come up with a system? Maybe in the future, if you hear me say it right then and there, like, ding, 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 like, let's have a code, because I don't want to keep hurting you like this, right? That coming up with a plan and trying to create a code so that if I do it again, you can call me out right then in the moment, tells the other person, I really do want you to trust me.
Yeah.
And I acknowledge that I'm doing this. I want your help to help me see it in the moment so that I can really change the habit. You have to really show up in your change in order to build trust.
Alice?
Sometimes we give up too easily when we have to face the hurt we've caused someone else, because it seems like you want perfection from me. And I'm not going to be perfect. I can't. So you know what? I'm done. I'm done trying. Yeah. But it's not about perfection. It's about the ongoing willingness to be humble, to be open, and to keep trying, and admit the next time you fall when you fell. Because it's that system that rebuilds trust. It's not perfectionism, because we can't achieve that. But we can build trust while we are still imperfect, but trying and open to talking about it.
And when the person is re-triggered by your old hurt, acknowledge it again. I'm so sorry that that happened. I really regret it. Just be with them in it, in the grief.
So you should never say, haven't you gotten over it yet?
No, no. Once you brought this thing into our relationship, it is now a part of the relationship.
Yes.
And you don't get to tell me to stop thinking about it.
Yeah. Even if it's decades later.
Even if it's decades later.
Yeah. Just wanted to hammer that point home, because a lot
of
people
might think,
you brought
this to me. Now we got it.
Please help, says Amber. My husband and I have been married for 1.5 years. In that time, he's cheated on me twice. I take my marriage very seriously and only ask for what I give in return, which is not any of this. By me being true to my vows, do I keep forgiving and working on a marriage where history repeats itself? I love my husband, but I feel like this is mental and emotional abuse. Please help me find some clarity in all of this. What do you guys say to Amber?
I'm going to address one thing. I'm going to hand this over to Jill.
Okay.
She said, I take my marriage very seriously. Mm-hmm. I think it's the wrong thing to take seriously.
Mm.
I think she should take marriage seriously, not her own marriage. And what I, here's what I mean
Explain.
By that.
Okay. I get what you're saying.
I don't. I don't get what he's saying.
So I take marriage, which defined biblically as a man and woman committed to each other, remaining sexually committed to
faithful.
Each other, faithful, no infidelity. This is not that marriage. Mm. This is a different marriage.
Okay.
That he's not taking seriously.
Yeah.
So I can't take him seriously either. Mm. And that's what I mean. Hey, I take marriage seriously. When you then the standard becomes very different. Mm-hmm. Then the mind shift is like, wait a second. I can't take this one very seriously because he's not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. And that's what I mean by that. Mm. You know, because when sometimes if we have an unrepentant serial cheater and we're trying to then we keep ourselves trapped by saying, well, no, I can't divorce or I can't separate or I can't get safe because I take marriage seriously. I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa. What marriage are you taking seriously?
Right. But I do really understand that because the marital vows and when you go through marital problems, mm-hmm. you really realize how important the vows are.
Yes. Yeah.
But you cannot be the only person holding onto the vows.
That's exactly right.
Right? Yep. It's like half of an arch. It mm-hmm. doesn't work. And yet, that's where the focus is. So I love the distinction that you're mm-hmm. making because she is focusing on the wrong thing. And okay, here she's a year and a half married. And husband's cheating. I wonder if this was happening before.
Oh,
did
right.
she
for
know?
Sure, right. Yeah.
Did she not know? And then what's going on, husband? Hey, what is going on with you that you are so afraid of actual intimacy that you are seeking false representation of intimacy?
Yeah.
And damaging our marriage in the process. Like, this needs to be seriously addressed.
Yeah.
And is he willing? And I think that's where, because she's also focused on, she's done everything she can. Okay. So does yeah. that mean husband is unwilling? Husband is denying the problem. So again, she can only do so much, but I think she has to put it out there that we need to do something here. This isn't normal relating. This isn't how marriage is supposed to go.
And I think to follow that line, because I think it's right on, is that she has to then take that next step and being like, you either go to every man's battle mm-hmm. or I'm filing for legal separation. Mm-hmm. Again, to your point, a year and a half in, two infidelities. Mm-hmm. So this is not, these aren't one-offs.
Right. No.
This is a pattern of behavior.
Right.
That's causing a
but
lot of pain.
But he has some attachment issues that
for
really
sure.
need to be addressed.
Yes. And I would encourage her to immediately sign up for Restore,
yeah.
you know, mm-hmm. and I know I can hear the listener on the other side. It's like, oh, you're just promoting your, you know, but listen, we wouldn't do it if it doesn't work.
Right. Because yeah. they're intensive.
Yes.
Right. You block everything else out and you get to do a deep dive into these issues that help set you up to do the work moving forward.
Yes. And I think that's really important that when we get clear, our decisions become easier. Mm-hmm. Having an intensive provides unbelievable amounts of clarity. I can specifically speak to every man's battle. You will get clear on a 360 view of your internal world mm-hmm. and what drives unhealthy sexual behavior. You'll get clear on its consequences. You'll get clear on its history so that denial melts away and now you can make the right decisions moving forward because you have clarity in the right path.
Well, and I think Restore does the same thing for
yes.
women because
yeah.
when you're in isolation, the embarrassment, the Christian ideas and ideals of I'm not supposed to speak ill of my husband, I have to work this out. Then when you go and you hear other women and the mm-hmm. struggles and you realize, oh, this is unacceptable.
Yeah.
Right. You gain some strength and some backbone to do the loving thing that you need to do.
Absolutely. And I can validate my fears. I can validate mm-hmm. my hurts. I can validate my questions that I don't have to now, if he's gaslighting, I don't have to participate in gaslighting myself anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I don't have to think that I'm crazy.
Exactly.
Right? Because
yeah.
the person who isn't acting out is usually doing a lot of self-reflecting. Mm-hmm. If only I do it different. Like Amber is asking, you know, have I done everything that yeah. I need to do? Right? Well, she's not the one that needs to do more. He needs to do more.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure.
And that's what Amber says here. Do I keep forgiving and working on a marriage where history repeats itself? So I don't know what she's doing to work on the marriage. She says, do I keep working on a marriage? But it's time for him to get involved.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and I think that there is this common, very common mistake about forgiveness is that she says, I keep forgiving. I said, okay, great. But that's for you. It's not for him.
Right.
The key is, do I keep trusting? Mm-hmm. You're confusing trust and forgiveness.
Yeah, no.
So forgiving is letting him go and his decisions mm-hmm. and letting him off the hook for his decision. But trust is something completely different. Mm-hmm. Trust is building the security and the trustworthiness to provide strength in the marriage so it can be repaired. Mm-hmm. So again, forgiveness does not constitute closeness. Mm-hmm. And so the trust part is the part that needs to be worked on and focused on.
Mm-hmm. It would be good for Amber to get our book Worthy of Her Trust.
Yeah, she that's can available in the newlife.com mm-hmm. store for sure. So she's also wondering if this is mental and emotional abuse.
Yes.
Would you mm-hmm. say yes?
Yeah.
Yes to both.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But the three intensives that we offer throughout the year, Amber, you should definitely attend the Restore Healing After Betrayal intensive. Hopefully your husband can take part in the Everyman's Battle intensive because he's having these issues with sexual integrity. He's had affairs twice in the year and a half that you two have been married.
And I would encourage her to also check out, and obviously him, the Everyman's Battle podcast.
Mm.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, check that out today.
Yeah.
And hear them talk through what the issues really are behind the scenes.
That's true. That's true. So do that. And also Intimacy and Marriage for the two of you. That's another intensive that we offer here throughout the country, throughout the year. You can get more details about it at newlife.com.
Our Life Recovery Conference is always packed with great wisdom. The people that attend always say, oh, that was so amazing. I wish I would have known about this earlier. We have so many great teachings. And on this particular one, we're going to hear from Doug Barnes, who shares on the good recovery equation. Let's listen in.
My talk today is going to be on something I've come up with over 20 years of working with recovery and Everyman's Battle and just through addictions. It's called the good recovery equation. Why? Because we need to understand what makes good recovery. And so I came up with this good recovery equation. Really simple, but it's very, very powerful in its use. So let's start with what it is. The equation, good recovery equation. When we're talking about good recovery, we're talking about time plus believable trust-building behaviors plus the sanctification of my character. So time plus believable trust-building behaviors plus the sanctification of my character. So let's begin to break this down, and I'll do it in sections, and so I hope it'll be helpful. So let's understand what we're really shooting for. There's a verse in Proverbs, the prudent see danger and take refuge, but the simple keep going and pay the penalty. It's Proverbs 22:3. Recovery is a journey. Recovery is a lifestyle change. And so a lot of addiction talks about behavior and the way that we need to change our behavior. So we don't want to necessarily just change the behavior, although we need to do that. We need to change our behavior. We can't keep doing what we used to do. Remember that my behavior is what I use to soothe myself when I don't get my needs met and I'm not understanding what's going on with me emotionally. So we're talking through behavior versus emotion. So we have, once we stop the behavior, then all of that stuff that gets stirred up in there begins to churn up, and then I need to know what to do with that. So this equation talks through behavior and emotions, and it's more of a process rather than just content. The content is you going to rehab, or you going to an intensive, or reading a book, or watching a webinar, or listening to a podcast. We want to get beyond just the content, because knowledge does not equal understanding. And so I may get a glimpse of something cognitively, but this is deeper than that. And so we take data, that's the conversations that we have sometimes that says it was blue, no, it was yellow, it was 4:30, no, it was 7:30 p.m., it was red, no, it was green, you know, I went there, no, I didn't, no, you didn't. And so we get lost in sometimes the deeper data details that really throw us off. Where is the focus of our recovery? Is there a point when details are important? Absolutely. But what we're looking for now is, let's talk through the process. It's a marathon. It's not a sprint. It's not something that's going to be done in a short amount of time. So the process of our recovery takes time, and that's one of the components that we're going to talk about here in just a minute. So remember, it's a lifestyle change. That's the umbrella. I can't change what I'm not aware of. And so as I get more aware of myself, then my recovery is going to change as well. So let's dive into the different components. There's three of them. The first one is time. Let's persevere. Let persevere finish to work. Perseverance finish so that you may be mature and complete, lacking in nothing. That comes from James 1. A lot of us in recovery come here because we're fixers. We want the accomplishment. We fix it. We accomplish it. We accomplish it. We conquer it. We overtake it. And so we are doers, and we want to get things done. Recovery, good recovery, simply takes time. We're not going to finish this next week or next month. For a lot of us, this is going to be a lifetime of day-to-day work, and that's okay. For some of us, we're looking for an outcome. We're looking to get this done. Let me get this done. Move it on. I'm out. But that's not recovery. Recovery, because that would be just about changing the behaviors. Although we need to change those, the purpose is to get into our hearts and to change our hearts. And so that just takes time. We didn't get here in 30 minutes, and so it's going to take us longer than 30 minutes to get out of it. Most of us, it took us a lifetime to get here. That's okay. The process, not perfection. We're looking to keep the process going, not to settle for when it's over, because for most of us, it won't be over. We're looking for the finish line being when we stand before Jesus, okay? So that's about time. Also involved in time is a sense of urgency. When I'm doing my work, do I have a sense of urgency? Am I looking to get deeper into the work, but do it not lackadaisically and not a little bit today, a little bit on the weekend, a little bit next week. Oh, darn, I forgot to do it. I missed my meeting. I missed my check-in calls. I missed checking in with my spouse, girlfriend, or significant other. My accountability, that's not urgency. There's a time and a place that comes in a little bit from early recovery to mid-recovery where it becomes a more of a way that we embrace it, and it becomes a part of us. That's when recovery, that's when those around us know that recovery is changing, because that becomes our way of life. It becomes how we speak through different topics rather than, let's see, did I journal today? Did I write? Did I read my Bible today? Did I call my accountability guy today? It becomes more second nature. And we know that there are those four characteristics of a habit that we talk about at EMB, something that's done automatically, unconsciously, skillfully, and comfortably. And we want to get to that place in our recovery so that it's comfortable, yet I'm still using a sense of urgency. Again, what drives me to my behaviors? We're getting healthy needs met in unhealthy ways. And so I'm looking at, what needs do I have? Do I even realize I have needs? Do I even realize I have emotions that are sometimes driving this? That gets into the next two phases of our equation, okay? So that's time. The next one is building trust-building, believable trust-building behaviors. Dear children, let us not walk Let us not love with words or speech, but with actions and in truth. It's 1 John 3. I need to be conscious of not just having the intentions of doing the work. In recovery, intentions don't really matter. It's the actions and the words behind it. I can have all the great intentions. I intend to stop. We all intend to stop. But until we take the action to actually stop those unhealthy behaviors, that's when the real work can start. So let's talk a little bit about building trust building, believable trust building behaviors. Let's look at what they're not. This is not just about a list. It's not just a DIY to-do list. It's not just a project management list. It's not a list of, well, I did these five things today, and I did these five things the day before, and I did these five things the day before that. So I'm getting better. That doesn't really prove anything more than what I was saying before, that we can accomplish things. We can do things. Give me a list, give me a recipe, and I'll make it work. If that's the best I have, it's only a matter of time before those around us start seeing that I'm not really changing my character. I'm not changing the way I talk with folks. I'm not changing the way I interact with folks. So it's more than just trust building behaviors. It's not a list, but what it is me getting inside of my heart and wanting to be accountable for the ways that I misused my behaviors. So my time, where is my time? What have I done with my time? Am I accountable for where I am at all times of the day? My drive to work, my time at lunch, my time driving home in traffic, my devotional time, my workout time, my time with kids and time going to events. Am I accountable for that? And am I doing it not because someone requested it, but because I want to be accountable. I want someone to know where I am. I've been on my own, out on my own way too long. I want to be accountable for where I am, who I'm talking with, what I'm doing, everything I'm engaged in, because that's good for me. If I get out on my own and I get isolated, then I'm likely to misbehave, let's say. And again, this can be adapted to all types of addictions, escaping from reality, to get away from a present, unpleasant reality. And so when I'm engaged in having people know where I am, okay, that's one part. How about for my money, what I spend money on? Am I accountable for that? Am I accountable for my time, talent, and treasure, as they say? So every penny I spend, we need a paper trail. Maybe I don't need to carry cash. I don't need a secret credit card. I don't need a slush fund. I don't need a secret IRA. And all of that needs to come together in one place and be known. I'm only as known as I want to be. So in recovery, I can only accept acceptance if I'm fully known. And so am I going to disclose all of this because it's good for me, not because someone requested it? The more I push back, the more I'm wanting to act in and keep parts of my life still to myself. And that's not good recovery. So my time, talent, and treasure, okay? Where am I? Am I accountable for, if I'm going to be 15 minutes late coming home from work, I need to be on the phone and I need to be calling those that I need to call and say, hey, I'm going to be 15 minutes late. And you know what? You better show up in 14 minutes and 55 seconds. If I'm not, that just goes back to the way I've lied and deceived and held back and withdrew. I acted in with all of those folks that I claim to love the most. And recovery says, I want everything above board. I don't want anything that's not exposed, not out in front of me, not because someone is telling me to, not because a book told me to say these things, not because a rehab facility said, you need to be doing these things. No. I do them because that's the man that God is calling me to be, or the woman, or whatever. That's the person God is calling me to be today. And so I need to engage in everything being above board. Okay, so why do we need? Why do we need believable trust-building behaviors? Because I am not trustworthy. if I hide in the dark, if I keep things secret, which that's what addiction is, it's keeping things in the dark. And so we don't want to keep things in the dark. We need boundaries around our lives, around where we go, around who we're with. There's some great podcasts that I know of that talk about primary and secondary boundaries and all of the areas that we need to be open and honest and upfront about our lives. And for some of us, I know this is hard. We're dealing with the people we thought we were. And I'll own it. The man I thought I was, I am not that guy. And I've had to come to terms with, I've hidden a lot of things. I've said a lot of things I didn't mean to say. I've hurt a lot of people I didn't mean to hurt. But I did do all those things. And so how can I repair that? I cannot be trusted until I become trustworthy. So this is not just how I can do a list. It's from my heart. I am doing these things because they're the right things to do for my recovery, not because I'm being told to. Okay? So there's way more to this, but for the sake of time, I have to move on. Sanctification of our character. It is God's will that you should be sanctified. That's 1 Thessalonians 4:3. So let's define sanctification to begin with, because that's kind of a churchy word. It's a long word. Let's put some definition to it. So here's a simple definition. The action or process of being freed or purified. The action or process of being freed or purified. So here again, there's that word process. So it's ongoing. It doesn't stop. Scripture talks a lot about our sanctification. And so am I even aware of ways I need to be in this process? So simply, let's talk about some of our negative character traits, some of these traits that come out. And I'm going to talk about some negative and positive character traits. And that's a short list. There are lists out online that you can find that have these listed out there. But the operative word here is awareness. So am I aware of the unholy trinity? Me, myself, and I? They get into some of these really negative places. And so my anger comes out. My selfishness comes out. My pride, my ego, being grumpy. I mean, how do these traits come out in conversations, especially around those that we say with our mouth we love the most? If I'm not being aware of that, then I'm going to continue to wound those around me that I don't want to wound anymore. And again, that's not good recovery. In conversations, in places I go, at church, at school, at my kids' soccer games, at PTA meetings, at whatever I go to, am I aware of how I'm coming across to people? Is my grumpiness coming out? Is my pride showing up? Is my selfishness out? And so if it is, I need to take ownership of that and correct it. It's not like I'm out on the basketball court and call foul, you know, basketball players, you know, foul. Yep, I did that. You know, I broke a guy's nose, but sorry about that. You know, no, it's not just owning it. It's now the process changes to how can I get my journal out? How can I start writing about this is the day, this is the time. This was a conversation that my grumpiness showed up and my anger was on top of that. And my selfishness came out. These are some of the emotions that I was feeling. And I'm writing about it to process through how those negative character traits affect everyone around me. Maybe I need to start looking at where the origin of some of those in my own life. I mean, that's a whole nother talk that we can get into later. But it's defining those for me. Now, there are not all character traits are negative, right? I mean, we got determination, optimism, compassion, trustworthiness, you know, being sensitive. Those are all great traits. But typically, those aren't the ones that we hone in on. And so am I checking in with my spouse, my accountability partner, my coach, my counselor, my accountability group? Am I working with them on, hey, I am trying to recognize these traits and I'm trying to work on them? And so if you see it, please call it out. But remember, it's not their job. This is my work. I need to become more aware of when these come out in my life so that I can say, well, hey, you know what? I'm doing it again. That trait's coming out again. Let me do some amends making, and then let's have this conversation again. So I'm going into prayer. I'm going into accountability with a accountability partner or with my group. And so I want to finish strong, but I'm calling myself out. The great Sun Tzu, The Art of War, he said, this is a paraphrase, if I know myself and I know the enemy, I will win more battles than I lose. Now, again, this is not about outcome, but it's a process of taking charge. So there's also a spiritual component here. Having confidence in this, that he who began a work in me will carry it out to completion, right? Philippians 1. We want to finish strong. So for today in our recovery, how does this work? So awareness is the key to change. I need to be aware that time plus believable trust-building behaviors plus the sanctification of my character will change the texture and the landscape around me, around my house, around my work, around my groups, around my people. And so I want to be really aware of how am I working through this process. And we've only touched on the real high level of it. There's way more components. There are lots of moving parts to this thing we call recovery. So this has spiritual implications, like what kind of man is God calling me to be? He wants me to live a sanctified life and to live in with godly character. Am I really wanting to discover that inside of me? Am I really wanting to do that hard work and to really sit with some of that uncomfortability and just say, yep, that's me. And this is how I'm going to work on changing it. So again, thank you for listening today. The Good Recovery Equation, time plus believable trust building behaviors, plus the sanctification of my character. I hope this was helpful. Have a great day and enjoy the rest of the conference.
We always have something going on here at New Life, and it's always about life change. We want to see God working in the lives of so many people. You know, you can always go to newlife.com and see all of the upcoming events, but here's a couple to put in your schedule. Our Everyman's Battle will be November 7 through 9 in Dallas and December 5 through 7 in Washington, D.C. Our Restore Women's event will be November 7 through 9 in D.C. And then we're going to have a couple of webinars coming up. One is Coping with Loss, our grief webinar, which will be November 13th, featuring Laura Manja McDonald and myself. And then Healthy Holidays, a boundaries webinar with Eric Thomas and myself, December 10th. These are online and they're easily accessible. Our events like Everyman's Battle and Restore are in person. And we would hope that you would share the information with your friends, family, your church community to let people know that there is help available for them. Remember, whether it's the holidays or just any old day, we are here to help. Give us a call for prayer, a counselor or a coach, a life recovery group, or even a book. In any way, we want to help you so that you can have a happy Thanksgiving. We run into people all the time who share us their new life story, and we'd love to hear yours. One in particular that I just heard was a woman who came to me and said with tears in her eyes, "You have no idea what an impact New Life has had on my life. I am forever grateful for the teaching, for the counseling, for the intensives that have made an impact in my life." I pray that if you've not had the help that you need yet, that you will connect with us soon so that this year can be the beginning of a new life for you. Thank you so much for all your support.